Rich Lenkov is a partner with Bryce Downey and Lenkov. He's also co-host of an awesome podcast called Legal Face-Off that you can find wherever your favorite podcasts are found and, of course, on WGNplus.com. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Good morning.
Rich, let's talk about this sheriff, Joe Arpaio, who was pardoned. They're calling it a dump-off. A lot of times with the news cycle on a late Friday afternoon into early Friday evening, sometimes something will happen on purpose so that it doesn't get much attention. But this is getting tons of attention, even though it happened on a late Friday. The pardoning of Joe Arpaio, Donald Trump's first pardoning.
Yes. 216 days or so into his presidency, which is early, but not the earliest. Of course, you know, Ford pardoned Nixon, I think, 4 weeks into his presidency. Clinton and Bush the second also pardoned people earlier. So it's not so much the timing as much as the substance of the pardon. Number one, he did not go through the formal vetting process that most pardons go through dealing with Congress. There's also an official White House office counsel for pardons. Apparently the president circumvented both of those processes, which is not surprising.
Within his rights, he as the president can do that. But normally, as you pointed out, you go through Congress first. But then there would normally be the fear that they would say to him, no, we advise against this. He didn't want to deal with that.
Yeah, Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, as you mentioned, grants the president pretty wide-ranging pardon power. So he certainly did so in a legal fashion. Politically, you know, of course, there's people questioning the timing, as you mentioned, on a Friday night, also in the midst of the hurricane in Houston. But as you mentioned, you know, there's really nothing that Trump does that's conventional. And of course, he tweeted about it. So, you know, that circumvents all the news cycles. But yeah, it was certainly legal. You know, the pardon was based on the criminal contempt conviction that a federal court judge found. The sheriff was ordered to stop racial profiling, and he refused to do so over the course of 18 months, and a second federal judge found him in contempt of court, criminal contempt of court, which is punishable by about 6 months in jail. He was awaiting sentencing, and in stepped Trump to pardon him. So now he's got a fresh slate.
Why does he do this? Why does Donald Trump do this? Seriously.
It's just playing to his base, right? I mean, I think it's clear that he did this to show that he's in favor of law and order, even though, ironically, by rejecting what a federal court judge said, that's the very opposite of law and order. But it's consistent with Trump mocking the judiciary on several occasions. Remember the judge who presided over the Trump University case?
Yeah.
He called him a so-called judge. He questioned whether he can be fair because he was of Mexican descent.
Yeah.
He ridiculed the Supreme Court Justice John Roberts, Chief Justice. So it's consistent with the way Trump has acted towards the judiciary. And again, I think it's playing to his base. I think, you know, someone who wants to build a wall, it's very consistent with talking about pardoning someone who is racial profiling, especially of Hispanics.
In the past, was there much, if any, relationship between Trump and Arpaio?
Was. Arpaio was one of the first people to publicly endorse Trump. So they've talked about being friends for years. Arpaio was an early questioner of Obama's citizenship. In fact, he sent a deputy sheriff to Hawaii to look for Obama's birth certificate, which, you know, was obviously a political stunt, not inconsistent with what Arpaio has done in the past.
Yeah.
He settled another case where someone, he alleged, planned an assassination attempt in a diner parking lot against the sheriff. Turns out the sheriff made the whole thing up. He staged this whole would-be assassination attempt as a publicity stunt. So sending someone to Hawaii to look up Obama's birth status, setting up your own assassination attempt, these are all stunts that the sheriff has been doing over, you know, six terms as Maricopa County Sheriff.
With Arpaio.
Stunning, right?
It's stunning.
It is stunning.
Yeah, it is amazing. With Arpaio, even though he was told to stop the racial profiling, he not only didn't stop, it seemed to spur him on and want him to do more of it.
He continued to do it. He boasted about it,
yeah.
All of which the judge cited in the contempt order. So, yeah, he flagrantly violated a you know, not only a judge, but a federal court judge. You know, federal court judges, pretty important people. They're appointed by the president of the United States, and they don't like it when their orders are not followed.
Yeah.
The sheriff felt that he didn't have to follow what the federal court judge ordered, and it turns out that, you know, that sentiment was, you know, strengthened by what Trump did on Friday.
So normally with the previous presidents, not the current president, but the previous presidents, they have some counsel that they go to and they say, hey, here's what I'm thinking about doing. What are the pros and cons if we pardon this guy? Does Donald Trump just forego that? There's no part of that in his...
So Trump went to Attorney General Sessions earlier and asked him if they can just vacate the criminal conviction. And Sessions, quite appropriately, said what any lawyer would say, let alone the chief lawyer of the United States, or any like thinking person would say, which was, yeah, not such a great idea.
Yeah.
You can't just vacate a criminal conviction of a federal court judge. So he went to Sessions. He did not, apparently, you know, we don't know all the ins and outs of it, but according to all the reports and according to the timing of it, he did not go to the White House counsel for pardons. He also clearly did not go to Congress. When asked about this, Sarah Huckabee last week said, you know, a vague statement about, well, certainly Trump would consult with his legal counsel about all issues. But, you know, to answer your question, clearly he did not go through the established process by which other presidents have used this Article 2, Section 2 power.
Does he have other people that he's considering pardoning that we should be aware of?
He's got about 10,000 applications in front of him.
Yeah.
You know, everything from, you know, people who are in prison for minor offenses to very serious and well-known offenses. Whether he will use more, who knows? He certainly has the ability to do so. You know, like we talked about, usually presidents will wait until the end of their term.
Bill Clinton, is also ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, then you're, you know, totally taking the easy way out by not having any scrutiny. But Clinton very famously pardoned Mark Rich on his way out of office.
A friend of his.
Trump seems like he's not afraid to use the pardon power, and I bet he'll use it again. But I'm not aware of any high-profile cases like Joe Arpaio.
A great text. Maybe Donald Trump wants to pardon him so he can hire him to guard his wall.
You know, that's funny, but he's already come on and said, the sheriff is, and he's 85 years old, I think. He's already come on and said that he'll take any job in the Trump administration. You know, on I think it was Meet the Press yesterday, someone had a really interesting statement getting inside Trump's head on this issue. They said that by pardoning the sheriff, he's really pardoning himself. He's really giving himself license to act the way
he does.
He does. And it's really sort of an interesting look inside Trump's head, but I think there's some validity to that. So,
is it true a couple months ago, and it's still playing through all the way into the weekend, people have said that Donald Trump has asked people if at some point he needs to be pardoned, if he can pardon himself. Is that true or is that just a story going around?
No, absolutely. That's a question that's been raised in the wake of the Russian probe, whether if convicted in the Russian probe, whether he can turn around and pardon himself. The answer is who knows, right? There's no precedent to that for good reason. Lots of constitutional scholars differ on whether that's the case. But again, Article 2, Section 2 is really widely written, and it's been used for a wide variety of crimes. Whether it could be used to pardon himself, I would say probably, but whether that would hold up in court is a different question. I think ultimately the Supreme Court would probably overturn that.
This isn't real life, right?
Makes
is
sense.
This virtual reality like you were talking about earlier,
yeah,
Bill?
Yeah, it is. All right, we'll take a quick break and then more with Rich Lenkoff. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach us easily at 312-981-7200. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder on WGN.
It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder. We're talking with attorney Rich Lenkoff. Saw this in the news. A 26-year-old woman was paralyzed when a bus shelter collapsed during a storm. And she was awarded what, the most that has ever been awarded here in Illinois or in Chicago?
Yeah, in Chicago, the largest personal injury award by a Cook County jury. Cook County, of course, encompasses Chicago. Last Wednesday here at the Daly Center, a jury of 12 people awarded this young lady $148 million to compensate her for the injury she suffered in, as you mentioned, the accident at O'Hare in 2015.
It was a bad storm. I know things happen. Tierney Darden, a dancer and student at Truman College at the time, sued the city of Chicago after the incident at O'Hare. The city had offered to settle the case for $22 million, but Darden's attorney refused. And how does it go from 22 to 148?
Well, the attorney in closing arguments, Pat Salvi, who's a plaintiff's lawyer, asked the jury for $175 million. As you mentioned, the city offered $22 million, and they asked the jury for $175, and the jury came back, not quite with what they asked for, but pretty close.
Yeah.
Fairly shocking verdict, not because of the fact that they found for the plaintiff, because liability was actually not in dispute. The city admitted that they were liable. This shelter had been very damaged, had not been maintained. So liability was not an issue. The issue was damages. The issue was how much this woman would get. And it was shocking because, as you mentioned, it was a record. But, you know, you see cases all the time with people dying, with babies having, you know, life-threatening injuries who get, you know, money, but not close to $147 million. I was just reading yesterday a verdict of someone who was 31 years old who died as a result of a surgery, and his estate got something like $12 million.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they hit big with this lawsuit. There's no question that this woman who's paralyzed now, who's confined to a wheelchair.
And she was a dancer.
Of course.
Seriously, she'll never dance again.
Yeah, so no question, a life altering injury, but the jury really sided with her in this case, no question.
So does the lawyer, I know this will sound crude, but does the lawyer play that up? Does the lawyer say, this is a very active young woman who was a dancer and will never have that dream realized again? You play that up to some extent, don't you?
Oh, no question. And not only through the testimony of the plaintiff, which in this case was very compelling because, as you might have seen in her press conference, she said, you know, they took away the two things that were most important to me, my legs.
Yeah.
But also through expert testimony, through doctors, through day in the life videos showing what her days are like today. Because, you know, you can explain to a jury all you want how impactful these injuries are, but obviously, if you show a video, that's you know, very strong. So through a variety of different pieces of evidence, they showed the impact that this injury had on her life.
Let's talk about the liability angle on this for just a second. The city admitted that they were liable. They didn't upkeep this shelter. You see this every winter. You'll see signs on the buildings in downtown Chicago saying, you know, beware of falling ice and stuff like that. How liable is the building should something like a block of ice fall from your building and hurt or kill somebody? Is that up to you?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So there's a theory called natural accumulation that plays into it. You know, we're dealing with basically premises liability kind of situations that you mentioned, or in this case with O'Hare. There's a theory that if the danger is caused by something that's natural, like the weather. So if you walk out of the studio and you slip and fall on ice, that's a natural accumulation. That's an act of God.
Yeah.
Now, if you can prove that the ice was caused because the slope of the sidewalk is different, or in your case, because the building had something to do with the fall,
yeah,
then there's some liability for the building or for the city or whoever. The fact that you have a sign up doesn't necessarily mean that you're not liable. It could, you know, mitigate the damages or mitigate liability, but the fact that you put a sign up doesn't mean that you're not responsible.
This is an interesting question, and maybe I stressed it in a bad way. Scott, your question?
Yes, I just want to say I feel much sympathy for this woman. She got what she deserves. So not to be rude, but how does it play into that she's a dancer, she can't dance again, as opposed to I'm a garbage man, I can't drive my truck again? How do those things relate to each other? She was hurt. Her lifestyle has changed, just the same as if a truck driver's lifestyle has changed. How does that specifically play into this case?
Yeah, good question.
That
so
is.
You would, in this case, they're arguing for a variety of damages, including economic damages, right? So they'd be arguing that, or they did argue that this woman experienced loss of wages and loss of wages in the future. So you would bring in, as they did in this case, an economist to show how much she could have earned in the future as a dancer. But I think to your point, it's a lot more speculative when you're, you know, a potential dancer than someone who's actually employed earning money. And that just depends on how strong your evidence is and how credible the testimony is. But to answer your question, in these cases, the way you prove those economic damages are through your own testimony, saying, I was earning this amount of money before and I can't earn it now. And in addition, you would bring in an economist to project in the future what you could earn in the life in your lifetime based on working as a dancer or a driver or anything else.
Great question, okay. Scott.
How about in the case of, you said a gentleman guy got $12 million. Does that come into play of what they were going to earn as well?
Yes.
That gentleman is dead. He can't do anything. And again, I don't mean to be disrespectful to this woman. She is alive. She can't enjoy her life. But if you pass away, do those things play in a court case as well?
Well, and usually if you're dealing with someone who passed away, you're not dealing with loss of future income, right, for obvious reasons, because you're not working. Your estate can't claim that. And in certain circumstances, they can claim, if they're minors, that they would have benefited from your earnings. But generally, those future lost earnings don't play into a case involving someone who passed away.
Yeah, I think that's a little askew, because if you do pass away from, let's say this woman had passed away, aren't her earnings still cut short due to the negligence of the city? So, I mean, I understand where you're coming from. That's the way it is. I just think that's askew. Her earnings are cut short, and the gentleman who passed away's earnings are cut short. I think lawsuits like this, we're going to start seeing bigger lawsuits, you know, as a result of this case specifically.
It's possible. It's very possible. Scott, thanks for the call.
Appreciate it.
Rich, similarly, there's been a debate for years of exactly how much is a human life worth, and I've heard lawyers make the argument. My client was a doctor, an attorney, who was making X amount of money a year, so you sue for the amount that they would be losing, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that plays into it. And to the caller's point, there's definitely a disparity between a lot of the cases that we've seen involving people who have passed away and someone who in this case is, you know, living. Certainly she's living with a lifetime of pain and agony and suffering. Yeah. But when comparing, as I mentioned at the top of the issue, when comparing this case, $148 million, to cases involving people who die, I think there's certainly disparity there. And why that is, who knows? That's the jury system. You know, you could have another 12 people look at the exact same case and find a lot less, and sometimes find no liability at all.
Thank you very much. I wish we had more time, because there are other stories in the news we would like to talk about with you. You will be covering them on Legal Faceoff, perhaps?
Absolutely. Legal Faceoff on WGN.
Appreciate it. That's Rich Lenkoff. We'll take a quick break. We've got news next, and then Eric Zorn joins us. It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder on WGN.